we're having, where voices, topics, and legendary stories come together, we haven't been connected. Switching to line one.
Video time, kids.
This episode is brought to you by themoneymultiplier.com. It's time for you to take back control of your money. It's time for you to become your own bank. Visit themoneymultiplier.com for more details. Also brought to you by PMC, Private Money Club. There are only two types of people in the world, people with money and people who need money. There's only one community that solves both problems. PrivateMoneyClub.com is the only dating site for money.
Welcome to episode two. This episode, we have Travis Wood. Travis Wood grew up at Big Bear, was a professional snowboarder, then moved on to marketing, worked with brands such as Forum and Sims. He has a lot of interesting stories and experience from the industry. Let's dive into it.
What's up? Welcome to season one, Forum Chronicles. Today, we got Travis Wood, ex-professional snowboarder, marketing guru, business guy, father, legend. What's up, Travis?
Hey, what's up? I don't know about the legend. I don't know about the professional snowboarder part, but the rest of it, yeah.
I mean, you're a legend in your own way.
No, I don't think I was a legend.
Hell yeah. Well, sick. Let's get
appreciate the props though, but no.
I got you, dog. I got you. Yeah. Hell yeah. Well, let's dive into it, man. Like, what's the backstory on Travis Wood? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a little town, kind of the mountains of Southern California, Big Bear Lake. And I lived up there from pretty much infancy till 11 or 12. And then I moved down to Orange County. But I grew up there and skied. Like, you know, when you grow up in a mountain town, you pretty much ski. Back then, anyways, we're talking about, you know, 70s and 80s. And so I spent all of my kind of childhood years there. We grew up on a little ranch, 4 acres, had horses and animals, and backed up to BLM. So I was constantly out fishing or hunting, being in the mountains. And after school, we would literally we had like ski lockers, and you'd take your skis and you'd go to the slopes and then go ski, and then your parents would pick you up at dark, kind of thing.
That's it.
So yeah, I had great memories up there in Big Bear.
So did you grow up like in Big Bear? Like, was it like Arrowhead right there?
No, like legit, like Big Bear City.
Oh, so okay.
Right. And so, my parents, my mom, my stepdad built our house that we lived in for years. And it was a cool vibe, you know, when you're a kid, like, I don't know what it's like in the concrete jungle, but like, you know, back when I was a kid, like your parents literally told you, like, go outside and pack a lunch and then come back when the street lights are on, literally. And so you weren't allowed in the house. So it was a great place to grow up.
No, I grew up the same way, obviously, from Salt Lake, whatever. But yeah. My parents just kicked me out of the house, like, get the hell out of the house.
Right.
But I had no problem.
You know, we, like, that sounds cliche, but, like, I literally had to walk a mile to the bus stop. And when you're, like, we're talking, like, kindergarten, like, a 5-6-year-old walking to the bus stop in the snow. And, like, didn't have to worry. We didn't have a lot of neighbors because we lived out in kind of BFE. And that was great use of survival skills at a young age.
Yeah, that's dope. I feel like times are so different now. Like I said, my parents were like, okay, go outside and play. Yeah. Come back when the streetlights are on. Like, there's literally, yeah. I had no problem because I hated being in the house. It's right. Funny, my brother would like sit there and play video games. I'd be up at the butt crack of dawn, gone, come back at, you know, right. the lights going.
Well, now,
what have you been at all day?
You know, this day and age, like, kids have to be entertained 24/7. Back then, we had to make our own entertainment. So, yeah. Different times.
Yeah.
I think times.
That was good. I love growing up like that. Just, yeah. You know, that's how I got into skateboarding, snowboarding, and everything else.
Same.
Actually, speaking of it, let's dive into it. How did you get into snowboarding? I know that a lot of snowboarders, they get the itch to snowboard because of, like, a skateboarding background or something like that. Did you skate, or how did you get into it?
You know, I grew up skiing, and like I said, I moved down to Orange County, the city of Orange, which had a great skate scene. I moved down there like 12 years old, and I got into skating and surfing then, and it wasn't until I was probably 17 or 18 that I got into snowboarding. It was kind of a fluke. My good buddy Brian Thien, him and I went to high school. And a bunch of them, Pat Monahan and a couple other guys, went snowboarding. And I had skied, you know, my whole life. And so I was like, well, I'll put down the skis and try this snowboarding thing. And, you know, it was more like drinking and going to the mountains. And so, you know, all these guys knew how to ride. And if you, you know, your first time riding is it's a painful experience because your body's getting contorted, your muscles hurt, and I knew edge control because of skis. Back then, those skis really didn't have the kind of edges they have now. And so it wasn't this like plank, shift your whole body skiing. Like snowboarding, you actually had to use the edges to really effectively ride the board. But I ran into this girl that I went to high school with, and she was a year older, and I tried to keep up with her and chase her down the slopes, and that's what got me motivated to snowboard. I just wanted to keep up with her. Subsequently, Brian Thien and I had this local shop called Hot Skates, and Hot Skates was kind of the it shop around Orange County, and the owner kind of has, you know, he had some good connections, and Steve Graham, who was one of the kind of godfathers of freestyle and big mountain riding back in the day, he was like our local hero. And so Brian and I would go in there and just kind of be shop rats hanging out, you know, waiting for the snow to happen. And Brian ended up filming with Fall Line Films and started getting some traction. And for me, snowboarding was just fun. I wasn't really in the scene at the time, but I understood what he was doing. It was cool being your best friend to see him like kind of take off. And so I started having, you know, kind of the goal and intention of like, I want to get free boards and free stuff, and, you know? And so that's kind of what got me into snowboarding and then into the scene. And just by default of hanging out with him, I met guys like, you know, Ray Berg and Nate Cole and all those kind of guys, is just kind of like the theme's friend kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
But from there, you know, it's funny because, you know, the intro and stuff like that, like, I was never a good snowboarder. it's just a fact. I mean, I think the most famous I ever got in snowboarding was somebody mistook me for Travis Rice. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Or then they thought I was Travis Parker or Travis Yamada or any other Travis Kennedy, but myself.
Yeah.
Like, and that was like as good as I ever got was like, you know, I would learn a trick and it would be old by the time I could get it down.
Shit happened so fast.
Right. And you know, when I was snowboarding in pro, it was after there was a stint where like Dale and Roan, all these guys were doing gnarly handrail tricks, and then handrails fell off, and that's when I like started to peak, and then my snowboard career ended right as handrails came back. So I got lucky because I got fucking broke off on rails. I respect the guys who can do that. The last trick I did was on a Form T-minus board with JP and Jeremy and those guys. And I had lost my contract with Joyride, and it was a double kink by some school, and I hit the top rail, and the board flexed and bounced me to the kink right in my freaking sphincter. And I saw stars, and I said right then and there, I was done. But so my point was, is I wasn't much of a pro snowboarder. I was more of a marketing personality, and I think people had to sponsor me because there was so little amount of talented snowboarders then that they were like, we need somebody. So.
Yeah, you, come on.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, anybody will tell you, like back then, I was more like, you know, the background guy.
That's, I mean, you were pro. I mean, not a lot of people get to say that. You know
listen,
even if it's for a week or 2 years, it don't matter. Pro's pro, you know?
I understood business because my dad was a business guy growing up, and so I knew how the system worked. And I got maximum amount of money that I could for doing what I could. And, you know, I was making like 30 or 40 grand a year in 92 or 93.
What's that equate to now?
I don't know, but I was living the life I wanted to live and traveling and seeing the world on somebody else's dime. And it was by far one of the best experiences I've had in life, for sure. So I'm grateful for the experience. So, you know, by definition, I was pro, but like as far as the riding goes, like I can't claim that.
I mean, handrails are a fucking whole nother animal. I respect, obviously, all the snowboarding, but handrails is just like, I will not hit another fucking street rail if my life depended on it. I know that was my strong point. I'll hit rails in the park, but going to set up a street rail,
right.
I had some friends call me last year, like, yeah, you want to go set up a spot? And I was like, get the fuck off my phone.
Right.
No way. There's no way I'm hitting any stairs with any rails ever again because the consequences are just way too high.
Well, you know,
I sound like a bitch right now, but I'm just being dead ass.
Right. Back then, like you had guys that were like pipe guys, you had guys that were rail guys, you had guys that were big mountain guys. I wasn't any of those things. I wasn't a rail guy. I wasn't a big mountain guy. I definitely was not a pipe guy. I think my claim to fame, I won one contest. It was a local contest of Big Air contest. And my sponsor at the time was a local bar called Murray's. And anytime I placed top three, they would give me free drinks. That was my motivation.
Oh, hell yeah.
Was if I could win a contest, I'd get free drinks. And so I, you know, like I said, I should have never been pro. It was the right time for me. And I enjoyed snowboarding, enjoyed the camaraderie. I enjoyed the punk rockness of it. I loved that other people hated it. Like skiers hated it. You know, kind of like Mark, like, you know, just freaking poke people. And that was my draw to it. And most of the kids, like, you know, like Dale, like we were all, in my opinion, punk rock kids. Even Russell was fucking punk rock. You know what I mean? And so that's the way I looked at everybody, is anybody that's doing this right now is a misfit. And that's what really drove me towards trying to get involved in it.
Always has and always will be. Yeah. Misfits. Yeah. That's why I love the industry too. It's a bunch of misfits. I mean, but that's rad. What was the scene like at Big Bear in the 90s? Like when we were pro, I mean, I think Big Bear is one of my favorite mountains to go snowboard on, like riding park. Obviously I'm a snowbird guy, but Big Bear always has the craziest scene. Like, you know, you go there and it's like, you're at the top of any run and there's just fucking chaos. Everywhere you look, there's 100 Kobe jerseys over here, Raiders jerseys go over here, and those are the ones you got to watch out for because those are the weekend warriors, you know.
No disrespect,
but we're
talking early 90s, right? And you know, you've heard the old heads say this, like, you saw somebody on the mountain, you knew them. They're snowboarding, you knew them. Well, all the skiers were going down like this, the snowboarders were cutting across and jibbing and hitting stuff, and it was just a really cool time of this sport that was starting to get some traction, and a core group of guys that were just freaking in it. Like I said, that were misfits, you know.
Yeah.
And this is back when park building just started. And so, like, Mike Perillo, who was an epic park builder back then, and Todd Prophet and Rob Defoe, and it was just a fucking scene, and it was every day, and it was in town, and it was, you know, back then movies didn't come out till a year later. So you were heard about people doing stuff, but you didn't get to see it till a year later. And J2 coined the best phrase, props to J2.
Love J2.
Sorry about the mic, but props to J2. But J2 called, he said, he referred to three places as the Bromuda Triangle. And it was South Lake Tahoe, Breckenridge, and Big Bear. And that was where, you know, we didn't have cell phones to connect to each other. We just knew that there was a circuit coming through with the contest, and that at any given time, we were going to be in one of these three places. And that was the scene. Anything in snow, there's snowboarding going on everywhere else, but like in the scene, those were the places. And so we were in the scene. And, you know, and when the contest would come to town and the Noahs would show up, the Palmers and the Roaches and, you know, Jamies and stuff like that, like, dude. It was jam packed because, you know, Big Bear, Bear Mountain and Snow Summit, small mountains.
Yeah.
So you would be on the chairlift watching dudes do insane runs. You couldn't miss it because there was only a couple chairlifts.
Right.
And so we would do laps and just seeing the progression in, like, in our own little microcosm on the right side of Bear Mountain was where a lot of shit went down, where Devin jumped that huge gap, where Wes Makepeace freaking jumped that huge gap. Like, it was cool. And then it transitioned into, like, Brighton was a scene, and snowboard, you know, snowbird was a scene, and different mountains in Colorado were a scene, and just these little pockets growing up and going into something bigger. And so, yeah, it was a heyday in my opinion, you know?
Yeah. I remember having a conversation with Mike Rehnquist and Del Rayberg when they were on the show, and they were talking about Tahoe was like a huge scene where a lot of snowboarding, like, developed. And I didn't really know that. I kind of, you know, from Utah, I always thought everything started at Brighton or Snowbird or Park City or some shit like that. But come to find out, like, there was just such a big evolution of snowboarding happened in Tahoe. Like, did you go out there, spend a lot of time out there with those guys or like in that part of the scene? Besides, like, obviously doing, like, contests?
You know, you did road trips and you'd meet guys that way. Like, you know, now, like, you could go online and you can see what John Jackson did yesterday.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's insane. Like, when we were doing it, like, you heard about Rowan doing some shit in Breckenridge and you were like, dude, wonder if that's true. And then you would go over to town and you'd meet these guys and you'd see what they were doing, you know? And every town had it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the magazines, you know, the ability to communicate was literally like on phone, like with a cord, like attached to a wall.
Were the
if you weren't there to answer the phone, We didn't know what the hell was going on, right? And so a lot different now. And, you know, you would go into town and see, you know, like Ali do his version of the Misty Flip, and or you'd see, you know, Dave England dropping something in Tahoe, or, you know, just that kind of stuff. And the only way you could get exposure to it is you had to be there.
Yeah.
You know, and every place had its own scene and they were progressing in different ways.
I wish I was around for all that, but yeah, the professional scene, like, who was kind of moving the needle in those days? Like, I know you said you shouldn't have been pro at that time, but who was like the guys you were like most like looking up to kind of like get your inspiration from?
You know, I think when you're getting into something, you're looking at people to kind of teach you things, and,
yeah,
and
sure.
you're soaking up information and everything. And so I was advised by people that were kind of telling me like, this is how it is. And at a certain point I was like, no, that's not how it is. This is how I see how it is. You know, and I had my own adaptation of it. But at first, like, you know, it was the films. I mean, it was always the films, you know? And so we were watching, you know, Fallen films, and then MacDog came out with Hard, Hungry, and Homeless. And that was like, that was the fucking game changer, because those guys were doing basically skate tricks on a snowboard.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dale's hair and just, you know, that punk rockness of it. Like, that's what I was like, this is cool. But, you know, there was a time there where you were a pro snowboarder, but you didn't snowboard because you were so freaking cool. That was the thing. And that didn't ever really vibe with me. I'm like, I appreciated it, but it was like, well, this is snowboarding. Like, we should, you know, ads should have snowboarding or something like that, you know, like the Dale Fork thing and the Roan couch thing and the Brian Thien, you know, golfing on top of a pool table. Like, it was cool aesthetically.
Yeah.
And it was cool. Like, these guys are freaking cool. They don't even have to snowboard. But at the same time, like, you know, so there was a lot of different types of influence, you know, and like, we're talking about a sport that came into the spotlight that had like some skiing type shit going on with this slalom and like tight pants and shit. There was nothing about that that was influential to me. I was more into the like breaking shit, pissing people off, and doing like gnarly tricks and just being ratty. That was my favorite motivation.
So let me ask you this. When you were younger and you skied, you didn't run the tight pants and like the whole fucking one piece?
Oh, sure I did. I mean, I think
you just want to know, you know.
You didn't have choices, you know what I mean? And so I think I rocked a bib most of the time, but, you know, I always said, like, skiing now, it's got its style from snowboarding. That all came from snowboarding.
Which came from skating.
Right, and skiing gave snowboarding edges. Snowboarding gave skiing side cut, you know what I mean? So there was a trade-off, but yeah, right. So my brand of snowboarding that I gravitated to was based on skate type of stuff. And I sucked as a skateboarder. Like, my freaking ankles sucked. So, you know, I was a really bad skateboarder, but I liked hanging out with the crew. But I appreciated it too, you know.
I thought that skateboarding has obviously had such a big impact on all the snowboarding. I mean, I based my whole career off Paul Rodriguez. I thought I was Paul Rodriguez on a snowboard. Obviously, I was never Paul Rodriguez, but I just liked that, like, anything he did regular, he did switch.
Right.
And I was just like, if I learned a trick, I'd always make myself do a switch because I just wanted to be like P-Rod, like, so bad, you know?
Right.
But, yeah, skating is just, like, the craziest influence. And then you see, like, the skiers take some of the snowboarding style. But I also see, like, snowboarders dressing like some skiers, too, like, you know, these days.
Hey,
and Jankos are back, too.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
Yeah.
I mean, listen, I was Jankos lately, which is cool to me, teach their own, but, yeah.
Ryan Immigard, who's a longtime Volcom guy, used to be a pro snowboarder as well. He had, before Volcom, he started this little company called Wides, and they were super wide denim, like ridiculously wide denim. And we used to rock, that's, you know, the guys made fun of it in videos, but we used to rock that stuff. And that all came from like Plan B pants and skateboarding and that kind of stuff. And yeah, I mean, it was, even though I wasn't good at it, I still liked the influence and the style and that kind of street hip hop vibe, you know?
Yeah, hell yeah. Well, back to like your snowboard career, did you have any sponsors outside of like Joyride and Hot Skate or Hot Skates, right? Is the shop?
My first sponsor, like, I don't know if you can see this, but I've got a little Movement logo.
Oh, sick.
So Movement was my first sponsor. Well, before that, Steve Graham gave me a snowboard, and he was riding for Lamar. And so that got me through a season. And then Greg Thomas and GT, who was, you know, he's a true legend in the industry. He was a rep for Moro. So he started giving me boards, and then Ride started, And, you know, back then it was about graphics. It wasn't about the board. And I remember riding, I think it was a Dale board. It was like 46. It might've been a Russell board. And I'm 6'1", you know, 200 pounds. And I'm riding this tiny ass board, but I was park riding. So that was kind of where, I got started, and Hot Skates obviously was my main sponsor, and the Bar Murray's. I used to wear their hoodies when I had to do contests, but, my first paid gig was Movement, and that was a company that, Matt Donahue was he was a pro rider for Joyride, super sick style. He was kind of like Thien, just big, tall guy, big arms, and he had crazy style. This guy, Mark Hibben, who's still a buddy of mine today. And then Dan Paterka. And Dan Paterka was a skateboarder for Evil and sick skateboard stees. And there was the three of them. And for some reason, I don't know why, but they thought it would be a good idea to put me on the team. And so that was my first experience, like getting paid. And then, you know, Special Blend. I think I rode for Dragon at the time. And I had all endemic sponsors. I never had anybody outside of that except the Bar. And I got paid a little bit. I say a little bit, then it was a lot, and I was grateful. Yeah.
How long were you pro for? Like, how long would you say, like 5 years, 6 years, three?
Like getting paid, probably 4 years.
You know, I think hell of 4 years, I bet.
Ended in 97 and got going about 93. Yeah. And I had a couple years in Big Bear and the majority of the years in Salt Lake. And that was a big adjustment, coming from riding a small park mountain to riding actual mountains, and the locals that, you know, were vibing. I think it was either Elf or Ox that, you know, when I got to Salt Lake, I lived with Whitey, Dresser, and LeBlanc in the beginning. And I remember we'd go down to some of the downtown bars, and I remember some of the locals being like, "You fucking Californians, you're coming out here raping our snow and pillaging our women." It's an interesting way to put it. And you know, but once you ride enough and you kind of pay your dues, you kind of get the locals' respect. And seeing these guys every year was cool to come back to.
It's still like that. We're still kind of like pretty fucking, we're like the surfers, you know, with like their territorial over our snow. I mean, going to the canyons and going snowboarding today is ridiculous. I mean, I remember growing up snowboarding, I could get to the mountain in 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Now I have to like get up 4 hours before I go snowboarding just to get there and beat the crowd. It's crazy. That's all you Californians coming out here.
I think that's probably one of my biggest turnoffs to snowboarding now, is just like, it's such an expensive sport.
Yeah.
And
you gotta reserve parking and shit.
Hammer you for every, you know, and there's just too many people.
So many.
Yeah.
So like, I took my daughter, riding, I take her to all the time riding, but I usually pack her a lunch because one day she's like, "Oh, I just want some chicken fingers and fries." I'm like, "Oh, no big deal, go get some chicken fingers." For $35 later, she ate three fries and a half a chicken finger. Right. We're taking this shit home with us. It's crazy.
Right. I'd rather, you know, spend the money and go to Baldface and get 4 or 5 days of just epic snow and then be done for the season.
Yeah, that's actually, that would be pretty sick.
It's sick. It's sick. Props to those guys.
Well, in your snowboarding career, how did your snowboard career kind of change your perspective or your outlook on the industry as you transitioned, you know, out of snowboarding and into marketing and stuff?
You know, I grew up with a dad who was Big Bear Lake. He was a prominent realtor. He owned a brokerage up there. He was a developer. And, you know, when you're young and your dad's, and my dad was also a motivational speaker. So like,
oh, sick.
I got hammered with quotes and inspirational stuff. And, you know, anytime there was a problem, there was a quote to go along with it. You know, if you always do what you've always done, you always get what you've always gotten. Yep. Just always something. It was like, dude, I don't want to hear this shit.
I think it's a Jim Rohn quote, actually.
But, you know, these things he instilled with me business-wise and you know, the mental toughness to be prepared for life transitioned in a way to business that I never expected when he was teaching me. And so when I tore my Achilles tendon in 96, filming with Ross Steffi and a couple other guys for a 32 shoot, and I knew then, like, okay, this is going to be rough. I still had a year contract. And the cool thing about back then, like, you know, if you had a good video part, you could live off of it for 2 years because it took a year to come out. And then by the time people figured out that you were washed up, you still already had a contract, you know? And so I knew my time was coming. And at that time, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I had talked to Transworld and Snowboarder about writing. for them and submitting articles. And I figured that, you know, I actually snowboarded versus some of the, like, as a, on a pro level, if you will, some of these guys that were in there that were writing and editors didn't. And I was like, I think I got a unique perspective. Yeah. I know these guys intimately. Yeah. Like, I think I got something to offer there. And they kind of brushed me off, you know, and I'd submitted some pieces and, you know, I was doing some, like, I can't remember what it was, but some, like, regional updates for snowboarder. And the guys, Ken Block started Blunt, and they liked what I was writing. And so they hit me up. So, like, my last year, my contract, I could was hobbling around. I started writing and doing interviews and stuff like that. And so I saw myself going into that marketing kind of, like, promoting riders kind of thing. And Jason Bump, at the same time, was a good buddy of mine. He decided he was done, and he was, while snowboarding, was taking computer design classes. So he transitioned from snowboarding into working for Four Star Distribution, which at the time was Special Blend Form and Foursquare, to working for Rawl effectively. And so I hit up Rawl like, hey, this is what I know how to do. I'd like to come work with you guys if you're up for it. And he said, well, yeah, we like that idea. I'm going to have a meeting with him, Rawl, Peter, MacDog, and Greg DeLeo. And let's, you know, basically an interview. And so I knew all these guys, but as, like, this kind of loudmouth, drunk personality yeah. snowboarder that really sucked as a snowboarder. And all those guys were kind of at the top of their game. And I literally sat in a meeting with those guys, like, you know, much like a room like this. Yeah. And they interviewed me. And I was writing crass stuff. You know what I mean? Like, when Blunt was, like, you know, the... I don't know what the word is. It was like the racy frickin' magazine. It wasn't your, you know, mainstream shit. You could get away with a lot. And they were nervous that I was going to take some of my, you know, vulgar personality into their clean kind of image. So if you've ever sat down with those dudes, you know, and MacDog's giving you the MacDog stare where it's kind of over here, but kind of there. And he would ask you a question, and then he would just look at you and, like, break it down. And he was the most intimidating to me. Peter and I already had a relationship, you know, DeLeo, whatever, and Rawl was just Rawl. Anyway, somehow I got through the interview, and they brought me on. And, you know, they gave me the title of Director of Marketing and Promotions and Media and Promotions, sorry. And so, you know, from there, it was like, okay, I would have loved to have been the caliber of rider that anybody that was on forum was. And I had it in my head that, like, I'm going to take what I know how to do. I'm going to take some of the stuff my dad's taught me, and I'm going to take these riders and I'm going to exploit the shit out of them like nobody's seen. And I looked at what everybody else was doing in the industry from a, you know, marketing, media, and promotion standpoint. And I was going to do something different. And so that got me in the door with Forum. And, you know, I don't know how much deeper you want me to go into this, but I wanted to be the best at what I was doing. I just was a shitty writer, but I knew how to work. You know, my dad told me, like, people will copy your sales techniques and they'll copy your marketing, but they will not copy your hard work, and you can outwork anybody. My dad was famous for literally working as an LA pressman. He would work three shifts in a row, which meant 24 hours a day.
Crazy.
Do it nonstop. Right. And so I knew, like, all right, come up with a good idea and just outwork people. And at the time, you know, like Mathis, for example, if you did a day shoot with Mathis, it was like $1,000 or $1,500. But, you know, he had to market himself to get those day shoots. Yeah. And so we had an amazing team. We had MacDog. And we had an amazing team manager, and we had an amazing crew, designers, everything. So how can we maximize this? And basically, I knew Burton had a staff photographer. I think it was Joe Curtis, right? And or Jeff Curtis. And so I thought, you know what? I can ensure that Rob gets paid monthly salary so he can know that money's coming in. And he'll shoot with the best riders. I'll broker all of his photos. I'll bring them to the magazines. I'll sell all the photos for ads. He didn't have to do anything but shoot the damn photo.
Damn.
Every time those guys' board left the ground, they would be filmed or have a photographer there.
Who was the filmer at the time?
What's that?
Who was the filmer at that time? MacDog?
Yeah.
Didn't everybody else? MacDog shot everything?
MacDog and Steffi and Ruben. And so Heine as well. And Heine's girlfriend.
Heine.
Right. So Heine's girlfriend, Cynthia, shot. We also hired as a photographer, and then Ruben Sanchez. So we had three photographers. And so, you know, these guys got to see me, the writers got to see me as a writer, a drunk. And so that's how they saw me. Basically no respect. Right. And I granted, I get it. I wasn't cool enough. That's for damn sure.
Is this before the Form 8 though? Just for context?
Well, Form 8 is a whole other story.
Okay, cool. I just wanted like,
And so we go into this meeting and I'm saying, here's what we're going to do. Every time you guys are doing something, there's going to be a photographer on you.
Sick.
And there's going to be a filmer. And I'm going to gather all these photos at the end of the year. I'm going to be in control of them. So your sponsors, if they want them, they call me. They don't run track down the photographer. Like, we're going to pitch them to the magazines. We're going to have completely control of all content and where it goes and how it is. And which wasn't like this revolutionary idea, but it was just something that hadn't been focused on at the time. And, you know, I basically pitched it to him like, you guys are the best. We're going to make sure that you are properly represented. And again, everything took a year. You get all the photos in like March and April, and then you go to the magazines, and the magazines didn't come out till September. And so it was a theory in the beginning. Now at that time I was also doing interviews, like, so I could write.
Yeah.
And Nico was a design genius, so he could design. And I remember, I know I'm long-winded on this, but I remember, you know, going to a, they used to have these Trans World conferences where you would go and meet with all the editors and the photographers and the ad guys and everything. And I did all the ad buys as well. And in the editorial meetings, the magazines would tell you what they're looking for. We're looking for sequences. We're looking for this. We're looking for that. And you had all these team managers and marketing guys that were like trying to tell the magazines what they wanted to see. And I shut up. I just watched. And I remember them arguing with the editorial guys. And I'm thinking in my mind, motherfuckers, these guys just told you what they want to see.
Yeah.
You guys are arguing with them. We'd like to see more pipe. We'd like to see more clear blue skies. And I'm like, they want this. So I shut up and I was like, I'm going to give them that. I'm going to give it to them on a platter. And literally, you know, after the year of snowboarding had happened and I got all these photos, and, you know, this, you've heard these stories. Like, I had binders binders and binders locked in a case where you couldn't get to them. Guys would show up, they'd look on the light board, boom, put it back in. And as soon as it was like magazine time, I would go down there and I brought Shem and all these other guys, like, photos. Here's JP, here's Jeremy, here's Peter. They would look at them. They didn't have to track them all down. I fucking did their job for them. Or I made it easier.
Yeah,
right.
Fuck yeah.
And Mathis is stoked because somebody's organizing his shit. He doesn't have to worry about it, you know? And so, you know, those guys would look through and they'd see a photo and they'd say, okay, I want this one. I'd say, okay, put a TW there. Great, you're not giving it to me right now. I'm like, well, I'm going to see what snowboarder wants to do in blunt and these kind of things.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, inadvertently, I played them against each other.
Yeah. Smart.
And, but we got maximum value for every single decent shot. And not only that, but we'd make copies of them. And I would go to Trans World Japan and White Lines and all these guys, and I would pitch them through the internet, like, you know, email, like, hey, I've got this teed up, interview, ready to go, put it on a disc, we'll send it to you. But I want a cover and I want this and I want that. And so, you know, in 1 year, it was like, you know, you've seen these guys to, like, we had everything.
Yeah, smart.
Right. That's strategic.
So, I mean, it's just, it's,
and that was like the pinnacle of anything really that I ever did there that was seen on the outside, is people started to be like, these guys are paying the magazines off. Like, accused of us of a bunch of shit. Like, Travis is going down and buying beer and pizza and blah, blah, blah. I was like, I bought pizza because I knew we were going to be there for 3 hours, you know? And so that was basically my main job. I also did a lot of, concerts and promotions. Like, we threw epic freaking parties at Vegas before our time. Yeah.
Yeah, I never heard.
And, you know, we put clothes on people. Like, I was in charge of all that. The only thing I never got any credit for was, you know, actual marketing of snowboards. But yeah, it was, you know, I felt like if I was good at something in snowboarding, besides from the physical act of it, like, that was my, like, I was the
marketing guy. Yes,
for a year or two.
Did you go to college at all? Did you like learn any marketing through college, or was it all just from your experience of like being in the industry and obviously like lessons learned from your dad?
You know, I asked my dad, like, how'd you come up with the name Travis? And he said, I thought it would be a good salesman name. You know, I mean, like, that's, my dad was a salesman.
You're born to be in sales.
Right. And so I just had that knack, you know, innate knack for like figuring shit out in marketing. And, you know, my stepfather, who's, I credit a lot to raising me as well. I had, if you ever read the book, Rich Dad Poor Dad.
I read that. Like,
so my dad was, I had both of them, the scholar and the business guy. And my stepdad, you know, he was like, you need to go to school. You need to go to college. You need to go to college. So I did 2 years of college, and then I got a contract from Joyride. And he was like, listen, you're either going to half-ass snowboarding or you're going to half-ass school. Pick one and go full board. And I think he thought I was going to do school. And I was like, all right, screw school. And I did 2 years. I had a psychology major that I was going after with a minor in business. And once I realized that I was in no position to judge or diagnose anybody psychologically, I dropped that. Well, you know, I had a contract with Movement, and I'd grown up with a guy that was one of the owners, and we used to clown him a lot. And so I would just talk shit to him all the time, and he finally had enough of me. So they let me out, or I was dealing my contract, and I was in between sponsors, and I had worked in the mortgage industry in high school, cold calling and that kind of stuff.
Oh, and there's a lot you can learn from cold calling.
Right. And so, cold calling air off a little, you know, 3x8 card.
Yeah.
Or 3x5 card. And so I went back to the mortgage industry in between snowboarding, and I thought I was done. And I was making like 50, 60 grand a year in the mortgage industry. And this was, you know, was 21 maybe, making good money. And I got a call from Joyride, and they were like, hey, we're starting this new brand, and we want you on there, and we'll pay you like $500 a month. And I was like, I'm making $5,000 a month, but if I could snowboard. And I remember being like, fuck yeah, I'm gonna snowboard. And I think Raul was paying me like $300 a month. It wasn't a lot. When it was all said and done, it was like maybe $1,500 at the beginning. What's that?
How old are you at this time?
21.
Oh, okay, yeah.
My rent was like $200 a month.
I'm sick. Yeah.
But I traded money, if you will, for a pop and go down, pop and go down. I don't think we were thinking about that. We were just going with it.
This episode is brought to you by themoneymultiplier.com. It's time for you to take back control of your money. It's time for you to become your own bank. Visit themoneymultiplier.com for more details. Also brought to you by PMC, Private Money Club. There are only two types of people in the world, people with money and people who need
a dream and a lifestyle. And I traded it.
There's only one community that solves both problems. PrivateMoneyClub.com is the only dating site for money. Brands are going out of business left and right.
Yeah.
When Forum was starting, did you think it was a good idea, or was it even a good idea to start a brand at that point?
Yeah, I think in hindsight, like 2020, like now you can look and be like all the brands that had gone under prior to that. But I don't think we were thinking about that. And, you know, Raul had Ingemar and Peter and... he had big ambitions, you know. When I, like I said, when I got there, when I got introduced to him, he had the company Switchbacks. It was a mountain bike clothing company, and he was tasked to kind of turn this business around. And so he's, you know, took the Switchbacks and did SB and called it Special Blend. And so he had the right formula. And, you know, I think he was influenced by guys like Mike Ternansky and Rocco and that kind of stuff that were wanting to build multiple brands under distribution. And so I didn't have the experience or the scope to think whether or not it was a good idea. I just knew like Peter was badass. Yeah. And I think at the time when I got there, it was Peter, Bjorn, and I think Duff. And those were the three guys.
Yeah.
Right. And so it was really cool to see the addition of the different guys that came on after that. And, you know, we can talk about that. But I didn't have any thoughts about it at the time, you know?
Yeah. This is probably like Peter was like at the height of his, Peter's still obviously the greatest snowboarder, one of them, but was this like his, like when he was just kind of at the peak of the industry at this point in time, like creating new tricks, or was he kind of just more on the back end of his career or just getting started?
You know, there was, so snowboarding is interesting, right? Like you had like the guys that are credited with starting it, you know, the Tom Sims, the Jake Burtons, the Sherman Poppins, the Barfoots, that kind of stuff. And so when, you know, like when I was a Grom, if you will, or coming into the scene, like, you know, guys like Roach and Ranquit and Farmer and Sanders and like all these, you know, like those are the guys we were looking up to. And the funny thing is like, now, like those guys were only like a year or two older, but they were a different generation. Mm-hmm. And you know, you had guys that like Rowan legit like had like one or two parts, but he's freaking legendary. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you had a 2 or 3 year career, like that was pretty normal. And so like Peter is just an anomaly, and like he had a long career in JP and Jeremy, but Peter was just really getting started, but he was probably like 2, maybe 3 years into like really getting going, and then being around all those other guys obviously propelled his riding to another level. But yeah, he was like, you know, it was such a perfect storm of a lot of things where I don't think you could take a snowboard team to Japan right now, you'd get the kind of like response that we had then. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, Peter was like new on the scene and the progressive guy and like one of the best riders at the time.
Yeah.
For sure. He carried a lot of weight.
Yeah, what were your thoughts on like Bjorn and Duff at that time? Because there was obviously before the rest of the team came on, but they got to be super young. What was Bjorn, probably like what, 18, 19 at this point, maybe younger? I don't know exactly how old he was.
Bjorn was young, and you know, it was like there's the Andersons, and then there was, you know, the Linuses, and there's a couple brother type teams, you know. And I had met Bjorn and Eric once with Perillo down at this house in Laguna, and they were on Volcom, and I was introduced. Like Perillo would always kind of give me like, these are the young Groms that are up and coming, and blah, blah. You know, Bjorn had a little bit of an attitude. He just has it in general, but like in the best way versus some of the other guys that were just dicks, you know. But anyways, Bjorn, I knew him slightly, and I didn't know Duff at the time. I don't even think I knew of Duff. But I knew, you know, Peter, had met a couple times, and because he rode for Foursquare and I rode for Special Blend, like we kind of knew each other, and Peter was just on another level. Like I remember like watching some of his tricks in that Transworld 4-1-1, and I was like, I'm done. I can't get upside down on purpose. You know what I mean? It's always an accident. I never land it. Like, you know, Todd Richards says, you know, the hardest trick to land is crashing. That's the hardest trick to do, you know?
Yeah.
And so Peter was, he was just then a league of his own, you know?
Yeah. Have you ever seen, I know this is off topic, have you ever seen Bjorn ride a dirt bike? The motherfucker can ride a dirt bike too.
Yeah, I don't.
I love Bjorn. That's what
I don't think I've seen in person, but like, you know, the interesting thing about snowboarding is a lot of guys that were good at snowboarding were good at other stuff like that. You know what I mean? But, you know, I didn't know a lot about Bjorn when I met him, but you know, obviously getting to know him, stuff like that. Even now I'm learning new stuff about him, like his, cause I hunt. And so he, you know, he'll go back to the Midwest and hunt whitetail and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So we talk every now and then, but yeah, no, I'm, you know, Bjorn, like when we had a lot of shit going on for Forum, most of our guys were filmers. We didn't have like a pipe guy, and the Olympics was coming, and Bjorn was like our only guy that like legitimately had a chance of like maybe making the Olympic team. So he was kind of special in that out, right? Because he was the only one that could give us a chance to do it. So
didn't he almost qualify for the Olympics?
Yeah, he did. I know there was some politics involved and stuff like that. And you know, like I was never like a pipe guy. I appreciated it, but I sucked at it. So I just never paid attention. I couldn't even tell you how to do, like if I saw a trick in the pipe, then I didn't even know what it was. Yeah. But I just appreciated this fact to be able to ride all the mountain.
Everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Everything. Right. Pipe was just, I know it's off the off fucking topic, but I try to ride, I ride with Louis Vito a lot. That's my guy. But one day I think it was last season or two seasons ago when Woodward had the 22 footer. Vito's like, well, let's go ride the pipe. You know, I'm feeling pretty good, whatever. Right. And he goes out and just does like, you know, just a basic air. And I come in, I'm fucking hauling ass. I fucking drop down the wall. I'm like, oh, jacket's flapping. Bloop. I barely got above the lip. And I was just like, I just kind of looked at it. Vito's like laughing his ass off at this point, dude. He's just like, what the fuck was that?
Right.
I got to the bottom. I was like, I'm never going back in there again. That was the scariest shit of my life.
You know, when I started riding pipes, like, it was more like wall hits on each side of the pipe. So I would approach it like a wall hit. And then when they got vert,
yeah,
I would still approach it like a wall hand, get fucking popped. And then on the backside, you know, you go up and then, you know, like you'd have to get all the way up and then come off your tail. Like I just could never put it together. And I got so jacked in pipes. I was like, I'm, like I said, my career, I wasn't an anything kind of rider. I was just there. Probably for moral support. Right.
Yeah. And to consume some of the alcohol, get it out of the way.
I was really good at that.
Well, jumping back into marketing, I know that Forum was more than just team riders and a boy band and you know, just marketing. But what were some of the campaigns that you think helped shape Forum in those days that you were involved with?
You know, I got to see it from like the Special Blend kind of startings to like all the way to the Forum. And Raul had a knack for that kind of stuff. And, you know, he... You know, what do they say? Like, good artists steal and bad artists copy.
Yeah.
And Raul would steal a lot of stuff and redo it. And it was just a cool direction on... we all knew we were snowboarding, but just to take it with, like, the bug theme and all that kind of stuff, you know, was pretty cool. But I think... but so, you know, I obviously the Form 8 was very impactful. And you know, we created a really good, I think probably image that all these guys were like super badass and they actually got along and blah, blah. And that was hardly the case. And you know, the Forum 8 thing, like it gets a lot of credit. It was funny because that was, it was such like a just fluke situation. Like you talked about Todd Hahn earlier and Todd and I were buddies and Todd called me. On a Friday night one time when I was looking at photos and he said, hey, I just got off the phone with somebody and Jason Brown is trying to start a rival company to Forum under Burton. They're going to call it Seven. And I was like, really? And, you know, he kind of fed me this information and I was like, You know, Raul always had this thing with Burton, like Burton's worried about it. I said, nah, we're the shit. And that's my Raul impression. And
I noticed.
I remember thinking like, okay, like we're on Burton's radar. Like they want to start something with us, you know, and or have a rival to us. And so I remember going into Raul's office with, I think it was Ruff and Nico, the ad guy, and telling him about this. And I'm like, these guys are trying to bite us. And so we got to come up with something. And we're, you know, we knew the name was going to be called Seven. So we're trying to come up with stuff. And it was the most genius and simple thing. Nico went in and took that famous outlined photo and called it the Form 8. It was, wasn't planned. It wasn't in the marketing strategy. It turned out to be something that we went with, but it was genius. And we literally, like Nico was infamous for missing ad deadlines. Trans would tell you an ad's due on the first, but really wasn't due till like the 20th. And Nico knew that, so he'd stretch it out all the way. We had an ad due that Friday. Like the 2 weeks, like it was really due. Nico had that thing mocked up by Monday and we submitted it and we put it in. And then Burton announced that they were doing Seven and it made it look like they were biting us.
Fuck, it was fucking perfect.
So I love that story because it was like, you know, not a lot of people know that story. And I don't even know if like Peter and these guys know it, you know, maybe, but right. But like it was a fluke and it was a phone call. That's all it was. It was Todd, that's like, just dishing shit. And I was like, ooh, we got to do something with this. I have no credit of, like, coming up with the form and like that. I just took the phone call. But I love that. You know, and at the time, like, you know, around Raul enough and you're getting into this. And, like, you know, you get into, like, yeah, fuck those guys. We're going to get them. They're going to get us. And we're the shit. And, but Burton's still around, right?
Yeah.
But it was fun, too, because, you know, there was kind of this rivalry with marketing guys and it was kind of like a fuck you.
Yeah, I love it.
I love that kind of shit. Like, yeah. Fuck you.
What were some of the other names you guys were coming up with before the Forum 8? Do you remember any of those?
There, like, we didn't.
I mean, literally,
we had ad campaigns that were already set in place. When that happened, we went a whole different direction.
Damn. So I had my accident.
That was a fluke.
Yeah, sick.
One of the greatest you know, flukes ever.
That's sick.
For you know, from a marketing and slogan. Everybody, we did a lot of shit before that and a lot of shit after that, but everybody remembers the Form 8.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, like.
And it was literally one above seven. It was just to make it look like, in my opinion, Peter maybe have a different take on this, but in my opinion, it was just to make them look bad.
That's sick.
Like they're following us. We're not following them.
That's, you said it was Todd Hahn, right?
Yeah. That's props, Todd. Yeah. Thank you, buddy.
Shout out to Todd Hahn, Shaka Hahn.
Did you hear that whole thing about Form 8?
Oh yeah, no, I was there for it, and I remember. Yeah. And
was that accurate?
No, I think that was pretty accurate. I mean, I think you told a little bit more detail with the whole Nico story. I don't remember that part. Which I mean,
Nico was he was infamous for missing deadlines all the time.
You ever hear anything from the Burton side about all that stuff, Travis?
Oh yeah.
What's the story behind that from the Burton side?
Well, so, you know, all props to these guys, because obviously it's Burton, but I think David Schreiber was the marketing guy at the time. And, you know, again, I never held the title of marketing. I was more of the media promotions, but I had a hand in marketing. And, you know, it was good because, you know, my snowboard days were done, and I wasn't competing against anybody. But, like, from a marketing standpoint, like, that was, like, my juice, you know what I mean? It's like, all right, let's see who can come up with some cool shit. You know, that was cool, kind of being able to talk shit and make it seem like they copied us and didn't come up with any original ideas. But you know, we were getting, in my opinion, we were getting shit from everybody, for, you know, people accusing us of paying off the magazines, to monopolizing the snowboard films, to, you know, stealing people's riders. And so it was just kind of along with the territory, you know?
But I mean,
The Lib Tech and the trade show story of making fun of the Forum 8 and stuff like that was kind of funny.
Yeah. They made fun of everybody, though. I mean, that was, you knew you were doing something right if those guys were, you know, printing up paraphernalia to fuck with you. And I mean, we got accused of everything from everybody. I remember Sal got mad at me because we did a party with Wyclef and those guys, and we called it the party. And apparently Alpha Numeric was going to call their party the party, and we got accused of, like, ripping them off. And it's like, dude, that's a pretty standard, like, the party name. You know, it was just like, we caught it from all sides. And again, I relished in that to make people squirm. Peter will tell you about that.
What was the whole gimmick with Lib Tech against about making fun of Form 8? What was the whole thing about? I never heard that.
You know, every year that they would show up to the trade show, Mike and Peter, it was going to be a spectacle. They were coming up with something funny, ripping on Skeen, ripping on Burton, ripping on us. And I think they had some, like, they made some mock-up t-shirt where it was kind of, you know, homoerotic, if I remember correctly, right? And, you know, guys, like, blowing each other and banging each other in that same silhouette. I thought it was pretty funny.
No way. I've got to get my hands on this.
Dogger got kind of mad at him. He's like, hey, you can make fun of the company, just don't make fun of the riders or something like that. So he had some talks with Pete or somebody over there. I thought it was funny. It's just, you know, one of those things where you get made fun of, it just makes us look better type of a thing.
You know, I think sometimes insult is the, you know, a way of flattery, especially for those guys, because those guys were, like, you know, in their own right, like, legends, obviously, and mm-hmm. to have them, like, acknowledge us, to me, like, have Burton acknowledge us, like, meant, like, they were thinking about us. We were renting, you know, space in their heads.
If you're getting hated on, that means you're doing something right.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is.
Right.
Right? Pete, you got anything on that? No, we're just talking about, like, having brands hate on Form because of the Form 8, and I'm just saying that, like, if you're getting hated on, that means you're doing something right. You're causing attention, you know?
Oh, no, exactly. And, like, the whole 7 story, I think I at the time when Raw was bringing it up, is like, I don't know, is that too mean to that? Is that kind of a whack thing? Even though as I kind of grew up on Big Brother Skate Magazine and saw all the skaters kind of do all that thing for years and kind of just have fun with it. It was still kind of a thing. It's like, is that the right thing to do? Kind of going after your own brothers and kin and stuff like that. But in the end, whatever. It's like Travis said, I thought it was fucking hilarious, awesome, and genius.
Right. And there was so much stuff going on underneath the 4-star distribution that it was, like, on the grand scale of things, a blip. You know what I mean? Like, there was always something going on. And, you know, the fact that, like, back to the Form 8 thing, like, I did another podcast years ago, and the guy that I did it with told me the backstory about Jason Brown and Peter and, like, the conspiracy that went on behind Seven and Capita and all this stuff. And that was a whole different take on it that I had never heard before about how in depth that Seven program was. And we just took it as, oh, these guys are trying to do what we're doing and we're going to freaking cock block them. And so to hear this backstory, even about the Jason Brown part of it, and no disrespect to Jason, I've met him a couple times, nice guy, but it was fascinating. And
what's
so
the backstory?
You know, I don't know that I want to get into the mental side of it.
Okay.
Kind of, you know what I mean? Because there's some sensitive stuff there. But what we did to do the Form 8, my understanding is set him to another dimension of conspiracy that, you know, Peter, you lived in his head for a while. I don't know, you know, what your guys' deal was, but hearing that was like pretty cool.
What was that, Peter? What's your perspective on it?
Like, me and Jason Brown are like good buddies. Like, we rode together. Like, he was awesome. I love that dude. I didn't get any of that, at least on my side of things. I didn't really hear any of that. How much of a kind of a project it was for Jason, and if he felt that we kind of swept it out from him. I didn't hear any of that stuff. He went on to do Capita, which is like an even bigger kind of creative project that turned out awesome in the beginning, was super creative and everything, and moved on from there. So I don't know to what extent that bothered him on from my side of things, but that'd be for somebody else to ask, I think.
Peter's a nice guy.
He's super nice guy.
He's a nice guy.
He's not going to ruffle any feathers.
No. I mean, and from his perspective, that's all true, obviously. I just, it's an interesting business.
Yes, very interesting.
Right. There was a lot of egos back then, too.
Right, there's still egos today.
Yeah.
It might have changed a little bit, but ego's still part of it.
I always say, Lego my ego.
Lego,
that was sick. That shit.
Yeah. I love it. Oh, yeah, since we're talking about marketing, what were some of the biggest marketing pushes that you were behind while your time at Forum?
You know, I think everybody there, including Peter and the writers, like, we were all part of marketing. I don't think there literally was a position director of marketing. I think, I have some standout moments in my mind stuff that didn't even pertain to snowboarding. You know what I mean? I think, we had a lot of influence in a lot of different industries, from music and television. You know, if we had skateboarders who wanted to wear our stuff, they wanted to be in the building. But I think, just like, because Peter's here. So we did a Forum tour, and I think we were in Norway or something. And I got a call from Wycliffe's road manager that they were in England at the Mobile Awards. And the Mobile Awards are like the whatever the music award is. Grammys, right?
Yeah,
the Grammys of the UK. And Charmont, you remember Charmont? He called me up and was like, "Hey, Travis," he's got this thick accent, "we're going to be in the UK and Wycliffe wants you to come over and hang out and blah, blah, blah." And I was like, "Peter, you want to go?" And we were like, "Fuck yeah, let's break away from the tour and go." And it's just Peter and me. And we went there and they got us a hotel room at this like super posh hotel room and backstage passes. And we got to go there and we got to see Tina Turner play.
Oh, sick.
And we were in the rafters watching it. And it was cool because, I knew Peter when I was a snowboarder and he was coming up, and I knew him through the Forum years. And it was cool because, when you got all those snowboarders together, it was like a bunch of fucking kids that were in a boy band. But when you got them one-on-one, it was different. And just being able to hang out with Pete and take that adventure and just go do something outside of snowboarding. Like, I think about like fun shit like that I wouldn't have never been exposed to if I wasn't snowboarding. But from a snowboarding aspect and marketing, like, I think the most thing I was most proud of was like connecting all the dots and really doing justice what the riders were doing every day out there snowboarding, capturing every angle of it, not just the snowboarding part, but the personality part, and getting it documented and published. I mean, because that's what those guys worked their butts off for. And, what I lacked in snowboard ability, I made up for in work ethic and connecting the dots. And I think maybe not then, but maybe now it's appreciated like what it took to like actually make that happen. No disrespect to the riders. It wasn't just the riders. Like, Ruff was an amazing team manager. Nico was amazing at what he did. Stephanie working with Peter in the outerwear. Like, it was a really combined team effort. I don't know that it was planned that way, but it worked out that way. And so from a whole, I think that's what I was most proud of, is just taking that approach and redefining how people marketed and got exposure. And, and, you know, staff photographer thing was the thing right after that. And just all the things that came from it.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to know, Pete, talking to you, like from the outside looking in and seeing what was going on, what was your perspective of it?
I think that was kind of the cool opportunity that Raw was very, very open to. Like from the very beginning, I was always, as a kind of as a creative weird kid, drawing up outerwear designs or graphics and stuff like that. So I was really just into the kind of creative side anyway. And but he was there to listen to what I was kind of giving him, and even kind of constructive criticism too, of like, oh, this graphics are horrible, or to like, oh, that's genius type of a thing, you know. To where like I was learning almost as a kind of a creative intern back in those days, from the very early days, on that creative side and product input. So I don't know if it was just me wanting to do that stuff at kind of the very onset of Forum, to that kind of influenced Raw to kind of always kind of have the writer contributions. I knew that was kind of a thing with a lot of brands, but with Forum, I think it was so much more power, and kind of like, what do they want to do? What do they, you know, asking them all the time, like, get us ideas, please, because we want your guys' point of view on things, of graphics, of what kind of products, from like the danglers that Jeremy and JP had, to like, you know, making this kind of random weird products that they'd be sporting and kind of and kind of owning on their own, to like this kind of me and Foursquare. It's like having that much input of the product designs from the very beginning to graphics and stuff like that. Yes, we had the whole kind of art direction team that was amazing, but they kind of take our ideas and make them even better. And so I think just having that whole writer input was such a huge thing for Forum, that kind of captured exactly what Forum was all about. It's about the writers, but also the writers behind the scenes had that much influence as well. Even with the ad and stuff like that, we'll kind of go by the writers, letting them know that kind of is what we're thinking. And so the writers are like, oh, that's stupid or whatever. And then they kind of listen to it, or they'd be like, you know what, how about this? Whatever, change it up a little bit, and everyone would be stoked and kind of be that much more into the brand, because they all had kind of a piece in kind of creating each little kind of element. So they kind of have that much more of a love, have a kind of, this is us, we're not just sponsored by this company type of a feel.
Yeah, I do remember there was, now that you bring that up, there was some intense moments with like product failures and coming from JP and Jeremy. And I do remember too, yeah, Pete, when he wasn't snowboarding, he was in the office in the design room, hunched over on the computer all the time. So yeah, I forgot about those kind of moments and stuff. Yeah. That was a, you know, you kind of, it kind of goes hand in hand, like you get rider feedback. But I think with the riders that we had, like there was no lanes. It was all about the riders. And I remember Jeremy and JP coming in sometimes and bringing product in and like throwing it on the table and talking about how shitty it was, you know, with attitude. And it was noted, and, you know, changes were made and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I that's right. That was a, we had a lot of meetings with the riders and open tables at, you know, either down in San Clemente or at Mount Hood and that kind of stuff. And it really was rider driven and focused for sure.
Well, I think also too,
like, beyond just the quality of the product, like, of course, like the riders going to have a lot of input on the bindings, the boots, the boards, how to make them better, like what's failing and what's not, like side cuts for their pro models and all that stuff for sure. I mean, that's always a kind of a given when their name's on the product. But those guys are also like very kind of have their own personalities, and one of the personalities to show off in the products that they're representing. And so that's where they also had a kind of a creative element of things, where a lot of other companies, they can kind of throw their ideas there, but usually it's like still just the brand, okay, we need to sell these and this is what's selling right now type of thing. But where I think at Forum, they took a lot of kind of risks in the kind of the creative and the colors and everything, graphic wise, and with the riders even more so than just like kind of the product design of making a better product. But yes, definitely Forum had to step up its game with products when a lot of those guys are coming in with broken bindings and boards falling apart and stuff like that. You know, like big, heavy, expensive decisions were made from some of those meetings for sure.
But I think that like that's kind of the evolution of a brand. Every brand's got to kind of go through those painful moments where it's like you're developing a product and the product's not working, but it's important to have rider feedback. What were some of the, like the biggest challenges you guys saw with the product? I know you said boards falling apart, breaking bindings. Was there any other issues that you guys had to solve kind of going through that whole that phase, like painful phase, we'll call it?
Well, you know, again, from my standpoint, like I was focused on the riders, the magazines, the different influencers that we were outfitting and that kind of stuff. And the product itself was, you know, I left that up to the product guys. You know, when it came to watching the riders react to the product, that was funny. There was some funny shit that went down, you know, because those guys, they were really passionate. And something like a forum that we didn't own our own factory, that kind of stuff. And you're competing with guys that do, that have like full blown staffs of engineers and that kind of stuff, along with R&D and riders and that kind of stuff that are giving you feedback. And so there is some disadvantage to that. You know, I think what we lacked in product, I think we made up for in marketing. Like Peter will tell you about those first boards that came out of the factory. Like they were freaking horrible. And the fact that we were still in business after then was pretty remarkable after that. But, from the outerwear side, all shots were firing. Like they were doing really good. It was the hard goods that was a little bit tougher in the bindings. I mean, you know, there was companies out there that made better bindings, that made better boards, made better boots. And so I think we had some stuff and we marketed it well. And we did, you know, what we could with what we had. But, you know, it wasn't, I don't think, and this is no disrespect to what the guys were doing, I just don't think we were at the same level as some other companies.
Oh, no, definitely not. Like, I think with the outdoor side, Raw kind of already went through those kind of learning curves with Special Blend. And so Special Blend was like already a few years along the way. They already kind of probably switched back. Raw can speak to that more to get to where that the apparel was at the time. But with boards, yeah, we definitely had our learning curves there with going to Rocket Science for the first, I think, 2 years or a year and a half. And those boards, like the bases are just coming out like hairy, basically. the die cuts would peel off mid-run. I remember Devin in Japan riding down, and he's just going down this kind of steep slope there because everyone's just tucking, and all of a sudden he just like brakes are on. Like, what the hell just happened right there? And he kind of had to basically walk to the chairlift with his base all peeled off.
No way.
The F actually literally peeled off the base of it from the die cut.
That's
fine. So I think it was 98 was where I think, or maybe a little bit earlier than that, to where we had to switch factories like right away. To where, like, I think that's why JP's board has all these different color bases, because like the first protos or the first kind of production runs were from one factory, and then they had to switch factories because this board was turning out junk again. And so we switched factories partway through, and it had different color bases and stuff like that. I don't know the complete details, but I think that's kind of what, cause I think that board, I don't think it was a die cut. Cause I think they just stepped away from the die cuts until they were going to be perfect. But even like with the boots, I remember the first time we started boots, and I was riding for 32 at the time, and it was like dialed in with my boots. And then we got our first production, and I got a pro model. It looked amazing. Like the boot was sick looking, but I put it on. It was like a ski boot to me. I had like really soft boots, and it was like a ski boot. I would not wear it, mate, or it threatened me. Like, you have to wear this boot. And like, dude, I came and rided it. And so I forget how I fixed it, like different liners or something like that to soften it up. But it was like, I felt like a beginner riding those boots. Like, it was horrible. And I think even some of those other guys, like, they couldn't even get their bindings on because they're so big puff boots. And they had to redo their straps in order even to get the ratchets on. And so I think we kind of learned from there too. Like, even my second pro model boot, or second or third, had like that Velcro thing across. It looked sick. But then, you know, we had to kind of realize and remember, like, Velcro isn't really working in snow. Like, when snow gets packed in there. So that just thing became a flop because, like, go into the Velcro, and then all of a sudden it just didn't work anymore. But it looked cool as fuck.
Like I said, well,
curves, but as long as this stuff looked good and the riders were wearing it,
and that's what we were the masters of, is where you could essentially take crap and make it look good. And we were really good at making stuff look good, but you know, it followed suit. I mean, it wasn't, there wasn't no, you know, there wasn't like, there wasn't any substance to it. It's just, you know, I think, you know, Steve, you and I talked about it. Like is Forum, was that a marketing company? There's arguments to be said that it was, you know what I mean? I mean, at the end of the day, maybe we're jumping forward, but if you're not running your business right on the back end, you know, doesn't matter how good it looks on the front end.
Does more fashion over function at the beginning, sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, in those first boards, I got one of those. Not only were the bases horrible, but it was the softest board I had ever ridden. And it literally changed my sphincter's makeup when I freaking got on that top rail and that kink and flexed it and bounced me back. I still haven't been the same. My voice has changed everything.
Board that didn't have any edges. Do you remember that board? Did you ever see that? What was that? Oh my God. That was the scariest goddamn snowboard I ever rode in my entire life. I rode that thing once and got just ejected off a little kink rail in the park, and I never touched it again. I mean, ejected.
You know, that
yeah, that thing did this.
A little bit, but not too much.
Yeah, I went through. Go ahead.
No, it's funny. Like the second year at Division 23, the little devil board, I went through, I don't even know how many. Those like 7 or 8 of those boards from breaking, but the edges would always just rip out. And so I had half my first kind of video magazine or whatever video part I was riding that board in, video magazine, I think, or when afterwards, half my video part was without edges. Because I just hurt coming out and I just pulled the whole thing out and I brought it without edges. And so it was a little bit slippery, of course, when it kind of would get harder, but like, during slush days and soft snow days, I didn't even notice it, honestly. Like I have some of my first corks on that board with no edges.
So they're unintentional corks?
Yeah, I was going to say. You're telling me one of the most influential tricks you've ever done was a slip out off an edge and you didn't have?
I wish I could claim that because I would. Like if I invented some new trick because my edge slipped out, I was like, oh, all right, I'll go with that and just pretend it, you know. But no, that was kind of an intentional one for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's sketchy. Hell yeah. Well, I know you, Travis, you mentioned something earlier, like you were, you know, in the early days, you guys were hooking up influencers, and this is before social media influencers. But I know that we've seen, you know, product placement on different celebrities, like on Friends, Travis Barker and whatnot. What was like, how did that all come together? And like, what was the kind of the mentality behind it?
You know, when I was kind of done with my snowboarding part of my adventure, I wrote for Blunt Snowboard Magazine, and so they would give me like a bunch of albums to review, like CDs to review. So I would review them, and then they'd, you know, have me write articles about this and about that. And so I befriended a lot of managers and people in the music business. And, you know, I paid attention. You know, back then you had Rolodexes of business cards, and I kept in contact with people. And so, you know, when Peter, you remember this, you know, when we did the interview, when you guys were thinking about hiring me, you know, I kind of had a vulgar kind of in your face style of writing. And I remember being in that room interviewing with you and MacDog and DeLeo and Rawl, and MacDog was super concerned about, you know, how I was going to take this thing with marketing and promoting you guys. And so I had to be careful about like what I thought was funny and cool and what the brand was moving towards. And I didn't get like the set direction by anybody of like, this is what you should do. I saw opportunities to get the name out there and I took advantage of them. And sometimes I would, you know, be like, okay, we shouldn't have done that. But that all came about by just keeping my contacts through writing for the magazines, you know. And I said, like, we would package together interviews. Like I did all the interviews, recorded them, transcribed them and submitted them. I gave these guys a fully laid out, done interview. And so I still had contacts with the magazine on that level, plus the ad buys. And so once I had something to send, like, you know, Wyclef or Method Man or, you know, what's his name from Friends, like I did.
Joey.
And that was all through, I think his, you know, actor name was Matt LeBlanc, but right.
Oh, yeah.
So, but like, I got in touch with their managers and like, hey, we got some stuff. And, you know, Matt's into snowboarding. And I'm like, cool, send it to him. We didn't even know, and he ends up wearing it, and we see it on there. Like, there was no like advance of like, hey, this is going to happen kind of thing. And that just started snowballing. And, you know, like a lot of the clothing back then was baggy. So naturally, hip hop artists would gravitate towards it. And so, you know, if there was a hip hop artist that was showing up at one of the mountains, 9 times out of 10, they did not have the proper gear. We'd show up at Special Blend of Four right before they'd go out, boom, throw it on them, and we would get all the credit for it, you know? And so it was right place, right time. It was, you know, they say it's not what you know, but who you know. A lot of that was, you know, happening. And there was times where, like, you know, like I remember, like, Matt LeBlanc, like, called me and was all stoked, like, hey, did you see all my stuff on, you know, I've been wearing it lately? And I had to tell him, like, hey, can you stop wearing it, because it was getting too much and too mainstream and not cool. And I remember Justin Timberlake's manager calling and saying, hey, we'd like to get some Special Blend or Foursquare for, you know, the show we're gonna do at Summit. And I was like, that's 98 Degree or whatever, NSYNC. I was like, those guys are lame. You know? So we didn't give it to him. And then I remember, like, Dub giving it to him, or whatever, what was the other one, the clothing, Alpha Numeric or whatever. And they're like, we gave it to them. Like, good. Like, you guys can do the, we were trying to be in the public, but not be sold out either. Like, we wanted, like, the Method Mans and the Raekwons and that kind of stuff. We didn't want, like, the Justin Timberlake, even though Justin Timberlake's amazing and cool. Like, we were trying to even be cool within a cool industry, you know? And so, but there was no, like, direction on that unless you did something wrong. And I learned, like, you know, Raul wanted that, but he didn't want it on, like, you know, like Coldplay, for example, or something like that. So it all kind of just, like I said, happened from connections of being at the magazines.
Damn, you turned down JT?
No matter who it was, it's still kind of a cool thing to see that, like, to see our influence kind of hit the mainstream or be, like, have those people wearing the products. Like, so it's still, like, it's like, oh, maybe it's not your favorite musician, but it's like, well, it, that guy's wearing our stuff. Like, that's pretty cool. I know Justin Timberlake did end up riding, whether it was my board or a Genius board or something like that. And Kristen, Cameron Diaz, their day at the time, riding one of those boards, but it was a Genius and one of my boards, I believe, that those two were riding. So, like, it was still like, whoa, that's pretty cool. Like, even back then, I was like, oh, Cameron Diaz is awesome. I don't know about Justin Timberlake, but it's still kind of, like, pretty remarkable. And even, like, Robin Williams is wearing Foursquare. And that was fucking amazing to see that. It's like, holy shit, Robin Williams is wearing my stuff. Like,
right.
Design. Like, that's really cool. So even, like, cool, whoever it is, it was still just really fascinating to have our influence that kind of high up in kind of pop culture.
Right. And, you know, and I think today, and I don't know because I don't follow it enough, but, like, there was a, you know, paths crossing of music and celebrities and our brand, and snowboarders were a lot more recognizable back then and, like, cooler. Like, the, like, Justin Timberlake's would be like, Peter, you're, you know, you're freaking cool. And Peter would be like, you're freaking cool. And, like, both, like, a mutual respect for each other. So, and to the point where, like, we were getting into Oscar parties and Playboy mansions and, like, MTV awards and stuff that, like, now as a snowboarder, I don't know that you could do it on the level that we were doing. We were at all the clubs in Hollywood that with, like, all the stars and, like, all that stuff because of where the industry was at, you know, partly to do with some of the marketing, but more just, like, snowboarders back then were legit rock stars that were appreciated, known, and revered by people in other industries that, you know, you would have thought, like, if I would have said, you know, here's Peter and here's, like, you know, some big rock star, I would have been like, well, I know Peter. No disrespect, but, like, this is a big rock star. And even Peter probably would have been like, woo, but this guy's like, that's freaking Peter Lyon. You know what I mean? Yeah. That was just a cool kind of, you know, thing going on at the time that I haven't seen since. And, you know, every, you know, snowboard generation has their cool things, but that was really a cool time to be. Yeah.
Imagine, like, going to clubs and meeting the celebrities and stuff like that. It's like, whoa, this is crazy. Where, like, the same thing, you get the mutual respect of being good in your own industry, and, like, snowboarding was a cool industry at the time, so it had the same respect of being one of the best in your field. Same thing as a musician or an actor or something like that. Like, you got that mutual respect, and I think it's still pretty similar. It's just, we at that time, there was no X Games or Olympics to kind of chart how good a person was, and so, like, you basically go around, like, oh, this is the best snowboard team in the world. So it's basically, like, this is the best band in the world or whatever. So you got that respect there. To where now, like, yeah, you have Shaun White and anybody who kind of gets, oh, this is a 7-time X Games gold medal. So they can probably get into that type of stuff too, because they have that that clout of those awards or the Olympic, you know, Shaun White's everywhere type of a thing. So I think it's the same thing. It's just a different crowd of who those people are. And I'm no longer in that crowd anymore.
I'm like, too old to know all this.
Travis Rice is, you know, goes to all those things and stuff and has that same respect because he did these movies and he's amazing. Snowboarder, yeah. Shaun White, of course. So I think it's still kind of the same thing. It's just a different kind of level of who is that kind of rock star in the snowboarding world. It's the ones that are on TV now.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right, Pete. I think it's like you only get recognized in snowboarding if you won the Olympics or if you're winning X Games. That's how they kind of people rate you if you're popular or not. I can't remember how many times in my career, like on a plane, people are like, "Oh, well, what do? You know, like, "Oh, I'm a professional snowboarder." Like, "Rad, are you in the Olympics? Do you do X Games?" "No." "Well, what do? "I fucking snowboard. I just don't compete."
Right.
You know, so that's.
That's way cooler than like saying professional snowboarders, like, "Oh, so you're an instructor?" Like, it's like that's the ultimate one. It's like, that's where I pull out the X Games type stuff. And then they're like, "Oh, you know," so it's like, at least that's like a little bit cooler than an instructor.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's
not instructors though, like, you know, but like when you're at that kind of level and you're hitting the jumps like that, it's like, okay, I'm kind of risking my life a little bit more than an instructor might, but I think, you know, instructors are awesome. Like, you know, I love teaching kids too.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting because there's so much information now to where you can get, you know, exposed to so many things without substance into it. And when we were involved in it, like snowboarding was like, you could dive into it for a lot of time of your day and really understand it through the magazines and the videos and all that stuff that you played over and over again, versus now you can just scroll through things. And it's interesting, you know, like when, you know, my mom or something, or my dad, when he was alive, would say like, "Oh yeah, my son used to be a professional snowboarder." And somebody would say like, "Oh, I have a friend that snowboards. Do you know them?" I'd be like, "Well, listen, back when I started, like if somebody snowboarded, I knew them. Now we're talking 10 years later is like, no, I don't know Chris in, you know, from North Carolina that moved to Tahoe." You know what I mean? Like, this ain't going to happen. And you know, it's always interesting too, even to this day, I ran into somebody the other day and they're like, "Oh yeah, I was in the industry." And I was like, "Here we go." And you know, so-and-so. Well, this person actually was like about my age and like knew all the people that I knew back in the day. And so those conversations are interesting because that was my time. That was my era. That's something I can relate to. I know these people. They have stories about them. There's some similarities. And that's no disrespect to what's going on now, but it was such a, there's just no other way to say it. Even talking to Stevie about his time, like it was such a special core thing where a lot of people knew each other. And like I was telling Stevie, you know, when Peter, you remember going into like the Bear Mountain Park Outlaw and riding up the chair and seeing people do laps. And then it was your turn. And we were just having this like skate jam type session with all of some of the best snowboarders in the world in this one little small remote area. And not that it hasn't happened since, but back then it was pretty special.
Oh, for sure. And then even compared from then and now, you'd see like the owners and like a lot of people from the industry up there. Yeah. The industry was a little bit more kind of working together. You see the trade shows, all this stuff. And now it just kind of seems like, oh, they work over there. They're not really part of the industry, it seems. Like, yeah, of course, there are parts of it. Employees are out there and kind of live, breathe snowboarding. But there's also like a whole other side where like an owner doesn't even snowboard sometimes for these brands that are out there. And it's like, right. It's back then, it was like a younger ownership who started these brands, younger kind of employees, and they live, breathe snowboarding, to where now it's kind of a bit more of the business side of things. Bigger companies buying up smaller companies. And so like the owners don't necessarily, you know, even snowboard. They just like look at their spreadsheets and see what's going on. And so it's the industry just kind of seems less tight knit than it used to be.
Right. Well, and you know, like in the same way that there was that scene kind of in Big Bear, you know, that everybody would, you know, be doing what they were doing in the park, then it went to like the team thing, right? And so then the teams hung out together, like the Forum team and like, you know, you had your M3 teams and your Burton teams, and that became its own little microcosm of a bigger scene, you know? So it was interesting to see that go that way.
Yeah, it seemed like back in the day, because we especially with the forum filming our own videos, we travel for filming our own videos, and so we always hung out together, and that was like something that other brands didn't really do their own team videos, and so their entire teams kind of filming for our different crews and stuff like that, so they wouldn't even necessarily ride with each other. Like a lot of times, like you have guys on teams that never even ridden together, type of thing, to where we're always riding together, we're always the same crew. Like, yeah, some people might be doing stuff in Whistler and other people doing stuff in Big Bear, but then we all still come together for certain shoots and switch off crews and stuff like that. And we go out and everyone just stay together. The entire team, like, we just go to a non-snowboarding thing or it's any sort of event, and we still kind of like hang out together as a crew, to where like that kind of had a gravitation to other teams would always be trying to hang out with us because we're having the best time. And our Raw was there, and like our marketing guys were there, and the entire crew was there having this good time. And so we'd always have like Todd Richards hanging out, and Devin's crew from Canada always hanging out with us. Like it was it had that team that was people tried to create, but it just didn't work unless you kind of, and I think the formula was like we were all going for the same thing, but we're also going for the same movie. And I think the movies did have a huge impact on how it created the team. We're all going for this one best movie type of a thing, and we're also riding for the same brand, so trying to make the whole thing that much better and living it really created something cool at the time that a lot of brands couldn't really emulate because of certain other multiple different reasons there.
Well, and I think we were partly to blame for, if you will, isolating the forum guys in that we wanted the team to travel together, not just because we wanted them together, but because if we had everybody in one spot and we had our photographers there and our videographers there, we could get maximum production out of every angle of it and every person involved, versus like Devin's here, we got to send a photographer and a filmer there, Peter's over here, like the resources, it would spin out of control. So by default, we created isolation, we created this, if you will, cool guy or too cool, or just an environment where guys were one upping each other because they were, if you will, forced to like, I remember having a meeting with you guys, and I was like pretty poignant about, hey, when your feet leaves the ground, you're going to be filmed. And when it lands, it's going to be filmed. It's going to be photographed. And like, we're going to capture every single aspect of this as we can. And that forced these guys to be in each other's space. And that comes with a whole other caveat of things. But like, we kind of created that bubble around us. And then when we were out at the trade shows or the tours or whatever, video premieres, then everybody got to associate with other riders. But for a long time, and at least until I left, like these guys only rode with guys that were sponsored by Forum, Special Blend, or Foursquare.
Oh, no, totally. And yeah, exactly. It worked with everything and made everything have that kind of more clean look to it from like the art direction. So the photographers would be out there and they're like, okay, they're shooting the riders for the magazines, but they're also shooting for campaigns, and they're trying to get the correct angle for these certain shoots that Nico or whoever the art director was at the time was trying to do. So it all kind of worked together in that field. So it all looked really kind of put together from the videos to everything. It was like all kind of designed out to have the same sort of look as well. So it kind of helped not just for the riders to be pushed for their own tricks, but also kind of the whole branding of Forum together. It's kind of had a super kind of clean feel to it.
Right. Cool time.
Yeah, that's dope. Well, since we're on the subject, you traveled a lot with the team.
Right. Right?
Do you have any memorable moments of like just being on the road with them? Anything that comes to mind? Funny stories that you'd like to share?
Too many. I mean, and I was only there for 97 till 2000. And we did everything together, not just in the wintertime, but in the summertime. We did summertime trips. Like I ended up linking up with these guys that did tours, college tours and high school tours. And they wanted our name and recognition on their flyers. And I was like, okay, well, what are you going to do for us? Like, we'll bring you guys down to, Mexico, and you can party with all the kids and their fans and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, cool. So Peter will tell you, like, it was out of control for a lot of things. So there's just too many memories. I mean, too many times, you know, running from police, getting in jail, like, you know, like endless amounts of stuff that had nothing to do with snowboarding, you know, and, you know, rubbing shoulders with Method Man and smoking a joint with them to, like, you know, being on stage with Wyclef. Like, it was just way too much stuff. But I think, you know, the memories for me were like I said, back then, everything took a year to come out. And so knowing that, like, would Peter would have an interview that was going to drop in Snowboarder and then Transworld Japan and then White Lions, culminating with this video part that also tied into the marketing, like, that was when all the ingredients, you know, came together. And whatever was going on behind the scenes, that's what people were going to see. But, like, you know, like, I traveled quite a bit when I was snowboarding, but I traveled a lot more when I was working in the industry with these guys, and created some great memories and friendships that I still have today. And, you know, what you don't ever get in a college education, you travel around the world, you'll get. And so I owe a lot of that to snowboarding and working with Roll and Peter and these guys. And, but there's just way too many memories to, like, there's just not one that stands out in my mind, because there were just too many. But I think the one that gets talked about a lot is, like, all the money that I took from these guys playing CeeLo, because, you know, there's different interpretations or accounts of what had happened, but the number was $86,000. And it was a combination of Jeremy was the big one, Bjorn was the second, and then Malamy. And I let those guys off at 10% of what they owed me.
I do remember that. I hated losing money more than, like, I never got into that whole thing.
You know, when I think about the group that we had there, the Scanners hung out together, JP and Jeremy were lovers. BJ kind of, like, you know, went from group to group. Duff and Devin were easy, and they hung out together, and Peter was kind of like his own, but kind of hung out with everybody, and Peter wasn't into that. But, you know, when Jeremy, I'll never forget Jeremy rolling in this Italian club, and he rolled a death, or no, he had the dice shake in his hand, and I rolled the best roll you can get, 4, 5, 6. And he owed me like 50 something grand at the time, and was just in shock. And the thing was, is, like, you know, like, when you're messing around with Europe money, it's not real. And then when you ran out of money, you could do IOUs, and it wasn't really real until, like, you got home. You're like, oh shit, you couldn't welch on a bet. And I got to see, like, everybody's royalty checks. So I knew these guys had the money, and I knew I wasn't going to take all that money from them. But that's the one that gets talked about a lot. And we played CeeLo with some gangster ass people. And we played CeeLo, you know, everywhere we go, like, everybody knew, like, we had dice. Every other, I wouldn't want to be in that room.
We're running out of time here, but I bet it was amazing times. Do you guys, Pete, this is a question for you as well. Do you guys see kind of some of the residue or some of the influence that you guys had when building Form and even your time at Sims? Do you still see that kind of going on in the industry? Like, people kind of not copying, because that's not the right way to put it, but, like, mimicking the Form. Do you guys see that in the industry today? Whoever wants to go first.
Well, you know, Peter's in it. Like, you know, like, so that's your question for him. For me, like, it was a real simple formula then that people thought was an amazing thing. It was just using your head and listening to what magazines wanted. From my standpoint, we had a lot of lead time to get stuff out. There wasn't this instant gratification that there is now. There was a romance to hearing about, like, did you hear about JP did this or Peter did that? And you were going to have to freaking wait. It was like the Ingemar backside air. Like, I saw the slide on Whitey's freaking light table. Didn't come out for 6 months, and, like, people talking about it. And I freaking knew that it was just a really cool era. And so, you know, like, I don't think the team thing is the same as it was back then. You know, the tricks are always going to be tweaked a little bit different, and there's going to be more of a spin or more of a flip off a rail or whatever, you know, people are doing off the nose and the tail right now. That's all stuff that's always going to happen. But the camaraderie and the vibe and the scene and the impact that it was, I'm not in the snowboarding industry. I just can't think that it's ever going to be like that again. And that's not to be an old head, but it just, everything is so much different.
No, I agree. I think it's for multiple different reasons. Snowboarding was new and fresh, and the next hot thing. I think that's, we hit a great time for snowboarding and had, like, a powerful team and was creating the sport at a time when the sport was still new to everybody else. And so I think that timing is what you can never get back. As far as kind of a super team in snowboarding, I mean, sure, you can have like the best guys on a team. Is it going to have the same impact as Forum did? No, because snowboarding was changing at the time. The whole industry was changing at the time. And we were part of that change of a smaller era. So where now it's an established sport in the Olympics and everything. And I think there are ways there'd be similarities of something that's impactful in the sport in different ways now. And we'll figure what that is. Like, when, I mean, there is like a Shaun White type of thing, which is a huge impact of snowboarding, but on a different level of sorts and in a completely different way. And so there'll be other things similar to the Forum 8. There'll be similar things to That's It, That's All videos that change snowboarding, the Ultra Natural contests or whatever they're called these days, the Shaun White. So there's going to be kind of different things that are going to influence and change the sport, I feel, but they're all going to be done in different ways. Like the next, you know, super team might not be that. It might be something completely different. Who knows? But there's going to be something that's going to influence snowboarding, I think, in a similar way, but just in a different way. Similar way, but just in a different way.
Yeah, that's a, that's a, yeah. I mean, it's ever changing sport, but yeah, it's gonna, I don't think there'll ever be another super team like we saw with the Forum 8. We tried even like
the 16.
Nice.
Yeah, that'd be sick.
Yeah.
But I think that's, we're coming to the end here, but I did always ask, you know, at the end, like, you know, where can people find you if you wanted people to reach out? I know that I got your number from Marco and you know, fuck, you don't be giving my number out, but like, what are you up to? Or like, do you have any social media or anything people can find you? Or you don't want to find you?
No, I don't want people to find me. People can't call me and know how to find me. You know,
I'll put his number at the bottom of the screen. No, I'm just kidding.
Cops.
I used to be a really good drinker, and when I had my kid, life changed for me. It was the best experience I've ever had, and I just simplified life, and I'm about being a dad now. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm fortunate enough to have made some investments a long time ago that kind of let me live the life I want to live, and I found that like less people I'm involved with and the more I can focus on the things that I love to do, live a simple life. And I want to keep it that way. And it's no disrespect to anybody, but like I said earlier, like just because you've known people for a long time doesn't mean you're friends with them. And I think people get caught up on that. Like, I've known somebody for so long and like you owe them something or whatever. And it's not in a bitter way. Just like, I'm just cool with where I'm at. You know what I mean? And if Peter called me, like I'd pick up the phone, you know what I mean? And Marco calls me, I pick up the phone. But, you know, 90% of the time when somebody calls me, they want something, and that just like, it just the energy, and it just gets draining. And not that I'm better or worse than somebody else, but I like a nice, simple life. At this point in my life, like I learned a lot. I've got a lot of passive, income going on. I invest in new and innovative businesses, and, that keeps my creative juices flowing there. I find a lot of solace in my faith. I find a lot of conviction in being outdoors and in the mountains, kind of like, you know, hiking up a peak and turning into powder field. Like, I'd really love hunting and being out in nature, and I'm satisfied in that point. And like I said, I owe a lot to snowboarding, because I would not be here if I didn't have that in my life. But it's also a foundation that I've built upon, and it's not a big part of my life now. I enjoy it. I got to see some cool shit that nobody will ever see. And right now it's just about, the only title that I really care about is dad.
Same.
And that's where I'm at with it. And that's where I'm at with life. And much respect to everybody that helped me get to where I am. And, you know, big props to Brian Thien, because he's the one that called me and told me to get out of town when, you know, people were after me and got me into snowboarding. And I kind of piggybacked some of his relationships. So thanks, Chico. And thanks to Peter, like, for giving me the opportunity to be at Forum and rolling those guys and daughter. And other than that, like, I said what I had to say. I'm sure I'll say more if you get me in the right position.
Yes. Hell yeah. Well, damn, dude. Thanks for having me. Appreciate you coming. Hell yeah. This episode is brought to you by Snowbird.com. I want to give a big shout out to all my good people at Snowbird. For those of you who are looking to chase powder this year, go to snowbird.com and get your season passes. Snow's coming soon. Don't miss out. This episode is brought to you by themoneymultiplier.com. It's time for you to take back control of your money. It's time for you to become your own bank.
Visit themoneymultiplier.com for more details. Also brought to you by PMC, Private Money Club. There are only two types of people in the world, people with money and people who need.
I want to give a big shout out to Snowbird. Snowbird is your one-stop shop entertainment all year round. Whether it's catching deep powder in the winter or going up with your friends and family during the summer, riding the aerial tram or the roller coaster. And one of my personal favorites during the fall, Oktoberfest. Go to snowbird.com, get your tickets. I'll see you up there.